I've been reading The Last Waltz in Santiago, and after going over some of the background material that the Viking had sent over to you, and biographical data, and some of the stories you had written, I thought I would be picking up an extremely angry book. And of course it was angry, but correct me if I'm wrong, I also feel a great sense of sadness in these poems.
Oh, you're absolutely right. There's a great sense of sadness and a great sense of loss, especially, because what we have had in Chile is, in fact, the loss of a country. And what is being ravaged in my country is not only by time. What happens when you're distanced from the past by geography and by bullets and by horror? And I think that the poems try to deal with this reality.
But you're not immune from outrage as well, are you?
Oh, I'm very indignant and very outraged, but I've often thought that screaming can help to relieve you of your indignation. But it won't help other people to understand and to relieve the world of the horror that you're looking at. So I think that these poems are very calm poems. They're very, let's say that they're quiet poems. There's a gentleness to it, especially because one of the problems in the midst of this literature of horror is how can you keep some form of tenderness, some form of gentleness and generosity, and some little spark of hope alive in the midst of it. And I really do think that the poems do that. That's why it took so long to write them. It took me many years to write these poems. Though, you know, the horror that happens is very quick and very immediate. But the recollection of it, the work on it, takes a long time. Not to be overwhelmed by the terror and by the fear and by the terrible things that happen that you're witnessing, but to take control of those things. The dictator dictates to our bodies, and we dictate back to him with our words. So we control those words. And I think that's what these poems try to do.
You use the term horror, and that's certainly the case, because there is nothing more horrible than the unknown and the fear of the unknown. The fact that people disappear and they're gone and we don't know what happened to them, or they're dragged out in the middle of the night, never to be seen again. That's what's really frightening, where you can't even, in many instances, find a body to identify.
Exactly. The problem is that when you have a body that you can identify, what you can do is you begin to bring that body into life. In the sense, you know, when somebody dies, we have funeral rites, we have memorials, we have graveyard parts in the graveyard, we have tombstones. And we're able, therefore, through our mourning, through our grief, by talking to the dead, in that sense that are there, that the dead body, even if the dead body can't listen to us, we bring that person into our life. We make a space for that person. Now, when a group such as the Chilean military abducts these people and takes from them not only life, but death as well, what they're doing is they're refusing us a place in the earth, as if we had never existed, or as if those people had never existed. What the poems do then is to work that gap, to make it real, to make that body real, to bring the body back, or to put it in other words, to give the body a burial in the words, if we cannot give it a burial in the ground.
Is there a precedent for political-oriented poetry?
Oh, yes. I mean, in fact, I would suggest that poetry has been political since the very beginning of time. If you look at the poetry that comes out of the Greeks, for instance, all their poetry is absolutely political. All of Plato's dialogues are absolutely political, most of them very poetic. All Aeschylus. They're all related to politics, because politics is not the contingent fact of who are you going to vote for in the next primary. That, of course, determines very important things of the state, but politics has to do with power and the fact of whose voice is narrating this. For instance, these poems are political not because they denounce General Pinochet. In fact, he's not even mentioned in the poetry at all. They're political basically because they empower the dead and the oppressed to speak. They give a voice to those who are excluded, who are neglected, who are ignored. And therefore, they are a form of empowerment, of giving people the chance of speaking out when they have been silenced. There are voices against censorship. And of course, in Latin America particularly, where we live very terrible situations of hunger, of deprivation, of illiteracy, and of terrible human rights records, then poems of protest are almost natural. It's as natural as writing love poetry would be in the United States.
Let's go back. You were not born in Chile, were you?
Well, I was born in Argentina, and when I was 2.5, I came to the United States. I came to this city, New York, and I spent the next 10 years of my life here. And the English that I'm speaking at this moment is proof of the fact that, in fact, I was brought up in the city. And then we went to Chile, and many years later I became a naturalized Chilean citizen. In a sense, you might say I'm more Chilean than the Chileans because I chose my country, whereas Chileans were just born there, right? And so I have this terrible nostalgia, which I think you can find in these poems, the feeling of, for so many years, not having been allowed to go back. And then finding, when you do go back, finding that the country has been really terribly deformed and defaced.
Why did your parents go to Chile?
They were in the United States, and my father, I think, felt the political climate, McCarthyism at that time, was not very nice. But I don't think it was basically that. I think that what they wanted to do was to move to a Latin American country. And the United Nations was opening up an economic commission for Latin America. My father was one of the major experts in industrial engineering, and so he worked on that in that sense. But I think they wanted to get back to Latin America. They wanted me, among other people, you know, to have an education in Spanish, and they managed it because I have been writing in Spanish ever since.
So you were 12 when you went to Chile.
I was 12 when I went to Chile. It was sort of a form of exile because I was just an American kid who liked to break, you know, I had a baseball cap and my baseball cards and classic comics and things like that. And so I really wanted to come back to the States. I've always spent my life trying to get back to somewhere, you know. It seems to be my fate.
So they moved to Santiago.
To Santiago, yes.
What was it like then as an American kid, effectively going to a strange country, a Latin country? Had you spoken Spanish?
I hardly spoke any Spanish, which was one of the difficulties that I had. But
what was it like growing up?
But you know, one of the basic experiences that I had when I arrived in Chile, we arrived by boat. And I can remember looking down, right now I can remember looking down on the docks and seeing the poorest people I had ever imagined that I had never seen in the United States, ever. And saying to myself, what is this? I mean, I knew about poverty, but to see this, to see that you have a majority of a country poor, for me was a very basic experience. And in fact, one of the experiences in the last song of Manuel Sendero, my novel, I mentioned this experience of encountering beggar boys on the buses, you know, and bringing them home. That's pretty autobiographical in the sense I would bring, you know, kids back home and say, let's feed them. But, you know, you cannot feed every child through charity. There's got to be something wrong with a system which produces so much food, which has so much strength in it, and which is unable to feed its people. After all, we have all this industrial capacity, right? We're able to get to the moon, and we can't get to the stomach of little kids who are hungry. There are millions of kids hungry in the world today. I think it's a shame, and I dedicated the rest of my existence, as I will continue to do, to try to find a world where there is more justice and to do it with peace.
Did you go to university?
I went to the university in Santiago, studied literature, and graduated.
What was the political climate like in this poverty area?
Well, what you had, basically, and it is still the case in Chile, in spite of the fact that we have this terrible dictator, it was a country that was very peaceful and that understood that through political means, through democratic means, the majority of the country could participate in the changing of its own destiny and the taking of control of its people, of its own economy and its own social and political life. And this culminated, as I understand it, in the Allende years. But Allende was just the culmination of many years of political participation. It was a very democratic society. So there was a quite agitated climate at that time, you know, when I was in the university. And I think it determined me for the rest of my life in that sense. Now, I've always worried about the fact of not writing political poetry in the immediate sense of poetry which will have an immediate effect on somebody, you know, vote this way or vote, don't vote that way. I mean, I'm not interested in influencing people in that sense. I'm interested in having people ask themselves questions about power, about men-women relationships, about terror, about pain, about loss, and especially about language. And I think, you know, that these poems really are poems that deal with many questions which are not only about the disappeared. After all, if we think four or five generations back, we know nothing of the people who lived then, right? Aren't they disappeared? They are disappeared in a sense, right? They've been erased. And the last song of Manuel Sendero, the novel, speaks about this at great length, of what I call the remote dead, the definite dead. So when I'm speaking about somebody who's missing, but who was missing was your father, or who's your daughter, or who's your wife, I mean, when I'm speaking of these situations, I'm really talking about a major problem of humanity, which is, how do we make those who have disappeared, who no longer speak to us, how do we keep a hold of them? How do we get that tradition to speak to us? And how do we therefore speak to the unborn? And the last Solomon Resendero, going back to that book now, is about the unborn. It's about, I mean, it's told by a baby who goes on strike until things change. So there's a sort of a unity in my work, which critics don't often see. They say, you know, I jump from one thing to the other, and I've now finished a book called Mascara, which is has nothing whatsoever to do with immediate politics. It's about a man without a face who steals other people's faces with their with photographs. You know, it's a sort of a thriller. But there's a sense to all of this, believe me.
Back to the chronology, just so I have a perspective leading up to your work now. Were you in Chile at the time that Allende was murdered?
Oh, yes, I was.
And you were working in the Allende government, weren't you?
Well, not exactly, to tell you the truth. I was basically a person who worked I was a university professor. I taught Latin American literature. And there were many other things that I did. I worked with the State Publishing House. Most of the stuff ad honorem, I helped bring out juvenile magazines. I had a couple of TV shows. And then the last months, in fact, I was trying to consult, to help the government consult on how we could bring artists into the mass media, because I felt that that was one of the major things that needed to be done. But I was never a functionary of the government. You know, it has been said in many places that I was a minister of culture or something like that, which is totally ridiculous. My real career starts after I leave Chile. I mean, I had a couple of books that sold well, but my real career as an artist starts after Chile. And I had no ways the sort of notoriety that I have today then.
What were the circumstances that led to your exile?
Well, you know, when a coup happens in a country which has no idea of what this means, in the sense that we weren't used to this sort of thing happening, it never happened before, in a way you've got to feel your way about it. I mean, they're killing certain people and not killing other people. So you have to decide whether you are or not in danger. And each person has got to make a decision. So after many weeks of thinking about this and running around hiding, it was the unanimous decision of every person that I met, and of my wife, who is a person, you know, who never makes a mistake in relation to these things, that I really had got to get out of the country. They had burnt my book, on television, in fact. They were threatening me, calling my mother up and saying, you know, your son is going to get killed. A good shot in the head is what he deserves, that sort of thing. And so I left the country. And it was a decision which took me a long time to take, because I really did not want to go away from Chile. Perhaps because, among other things, I had already lost Argentina when I was a child, right? Then I had lost the States. I had said, here I am, I'm settling down. This is where I put up my tent, you know. I'm here under this sky, this is my sky, this is my street. These are my people. And all of a sudden, gosh, going off to a place which isn't your own. It was too much, in a way.
You went off to Europe.
I went off to Europe and spent many years there and then came to the United States. And many of the experiences of exile are, in fact, very deeply embedded in the book that has just come out, The Last Waltz of Santiago.
But incredibly, you have gone back to Chile and keep going back to Chile.
Yeah, sure. What's incredible about it?
Well, because you left because you felt your life was on the line. I would assume from reading what you have written, especially in the essays, that your life is still on the line, and yet you go back.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm not foolish. I may be slightly imprudent once in a while, but I'm not foolish. Each time I go back, I wonder whether yes or no. Now, conditions have changed in the sense that there are certain people that General Pinochet began by creating a real massacre. He killed thousands and thousands of people, and tortured, and is still torturing people. But there is a certain umbrella that you have, a certain protection from his acid, terrible reign, by being somebody who has worked so much in the American media, who has had such success with his books. I mean, these are things that protect me in a way. And, for instance, the next time I'm going down, I will be going down with several television crews who will be filming what I'm going to be doing down there. I'm going to be working on a play. So there is some degree of protection, but of course there's a gamble at each point, in which you say, he will be more hurt by hurting me than by leaving me alone. And basically it's worked out, except of course that once I did go back and I was arrested and deported and I was thrown out of the country. So you can never tell what's going to happen to you, really. On the other hand, at what point can you allow the fear that you have, a legitimate fear, to dictate to you absolutely? Because, you know, if I were to fear so much that I would never return to Chile, ever, no matter what the circumstances were, even if there were the slightest chance of something happening to me, then simultaneously I would be condemning all rebellion and all change in history to nothingness. there would be no civil rights movement in the United States if people had not said, no, we're going to sit down even if they beat us, even if they set dogs on us. Of course. And they went on doing it, right? Now, that's a risk you have to take if you're going to make history. And I really feel that I cannot write in a certain way and not make history in the same way. In other words, I cannot not put my body where my words are. You Americans always speak of putting your money where your mouth is. I speak of putting the body where the mouth is.
But you're such a thorn in their side. Everywhere you go, you are critical, even though you use a great deal of subtlety in your work. And it would seem to me that going down there surrounded by television crews, at one point or another, you're going to have to go to the men's room. What happens if you go to the men's room and you don't have a return?
Yeah, well, I think...
Your voice will have been silenced.
No, first of all, it would have been silenced because I'm pretty sure that the next day you'll grab this interview that we're doing and you will transmit it, okay? And General Pinochet knows that. These poems are there. I think that General Pinochet has learned one lesson in relation to me, which is it's better not to repress me because the more he represses me, the more that turns me into either a martyr or a voice. Now, that's a risk I have to take. But once again, you know, after I went down to Chile and I had debates on with the Chilean ambassador to the United States on television, and I had debates with Jesse Helms and a series of other people, and I was all over the news, I took it easy. For 6 or 7 or 8 months, I didn't go down. I was right. That's when they arrested me. So, you know, basically, you have to keep on going. And your voice, I would really hate it if my voice were silenced, let me tell you, but I'm hoping that you'll keep it alive.
It must have been an eerie feeling that time when a reporter called you on the phone to announce your death. Tell me about that.
It was very strange. A reporter from Associated Press called me up. He knew me, and he said, you know, I've got this cable, Ariel, which says that you're dead. Obviously, you're not. Have you got any comments, you know, that I'd like to send over the wires? And I said, oh, I've been waiting for years to say that reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated, as Mark Twain said, and I'm so happy to be able to use this phrase. And, of course, you know, you use the humor because basically you don't want to think of the fact that everybody who heard that news thought it was true. Now, that gives you a really eerie feeling, the fact that people consider that to be absolutely natural. They didn't say, what? Ariel Dorfman died. It can't be. Nobody said it can't be. Everybody said, of course, just like you would say, right? Of course, it had to happen someday. They killed him. It's about time. I mean, about time in the sense that the guy is crazy. Why did he go down to Chile? I hadn't gone down to Chile. But what I mean is, in a sense, I lived through my death. I read my own obituary. Not quite. I really would have liked to have had... They didn't have time for that. They splashed it on the front pages of the Buenos Aires Press. And then the fact that I was alive stopped a lot of very interesting people from writing about me. I would have liked to have seen that. Maybe I'll write a story about that one day.
What is it in the Latin psyche that creates such a volatile situation south of the border?
Well, it isn't only the Latin psyche. I mean, it's very easy to speak about the culture only, a culture of violence or something like that.
But almost every country is unstable in Latin America.
That's true, but you could look at some economic and social and political factors. I do think that the culture has something to do with it. But in the case of Chile, for instance, what was it in our culture or in our economic and political development that allowed us to have a deeper democracy than you've got in this country at this moment? We had more pluralism in Chile before the coup than you have got in this country at this moment. There were more different opinions vying for public attention than you have got here. There was absolute freedom of the press. There was nobody, not one political prisoner. It was a very, very strong country. So I don't think that there's something in our psyche. I mean, I explore the hidden causes of this in my novels and in my poems. I look, for instance, at the machismo, right? In the sense that the way in which men treat women, I think, prepare them for the abuse with which they will then treat some of their fellow citizens. I think that's one of the causes for it, right? I think that the fact of the way in which Indians or blacks are treated in countries such as my own, is certainly the racism that there is, certainly doesn't help in that sense. But I think it's a very deep phenomenon, and if we had come to an easy answer of it, we probably would have organized an easy way out of it. We don't. It's a very difficult question. How can we stabilize? I would suggest that one of the factors for instability in our countries is certainly the stability of your country, in the sense that the constant interference of the United States in the affairs of our countries certainly does not lead to any form of stability whatsoever.
I was going to say the fall of Allende, I certainly was helped if if not actually created by the CIA. At least that's what we don't have any specific facts. But
oh no, you. I'm sorry.
There are specific facts.
Oh yes, but the Church Commission spent a year working on this. There's something like 7,000 pages of testimony. There's no doubt whatsoever. Seymour Hersh has written about this extensively. Oh, there's no doubt whatsoever. The United States Secret Service agencies helped to destabilize a democratically elected government. Now, that should give us food for thought. Certainly when the United States is saying we want to export democracy to Latin America, you should not export anything to any place whatsoever. You should export your goods, and we should buy them if we so want to. But don't export democracy, especially when the democracy takes a turn that you don't like, then you get rid of it. That's not democratic at all. You know?
I don't understand the government, any government. And the United States, when the Reagan administration was told specifically it could not support the Contra rebels, they did it anyway, secretly. When they form these secret groups, these secret intelligence groups, they do it to go around the rules that say they can't do it. Because it must be, there must be something in the seat of power that tells these people that they're right. And even though the Congress says we can't do this, we got to do it because this is the proper thing for us to do to make our country stronger or to eliminate our enemies.
But you know, the doctrine behind that is not that different from the doctrine that dictatorships use in Latin America, which is the doctrine of national security, and which says that national security is above the law, which is above all. And I don't think that's true, and I don't think that's right. I think that the democratic law, the law of the majority, is the law that should demand what national security. I mean, a secure country is a democratic country. So, of course, you see boogeymen everywhere. And I'm not saying, you know, that the adversaries of the United States are saints. Far from it. But if you use terrible methods to get rid of these people, those terrible methods are going to come straight back and strike at the heart of your system.
Well, Ariel Dorfman, we could continue to talk, but I know you have appointments and so do I, but you are certainly an effective voice in Chile. I know that they're not particularly happy about it, but what you do is to give us food for thought and make us appreciate, in this country at least, our own state of democracy and worry about what's happening elsewhere. And from that standpoint, it's a wonderful thing that you're doing. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. You know, the one thing I would have liked to have done, I would have liked to have read one poem.
Please, read one poem.
I don't know, have you got anyone which you...
Which
you like particularly?
Yes, let's see.
I
did kind of like the title,
okay.
But that had a...
It has a bad word
bad
in it.
Bad word in it.
But I can put bastard in. I've done this. I put bastard in.
All right, say bastard.
Okay. No, I've got it all. I've got it all down pat. Last waltz in Santiago. All that you've danced, they take from you. They just take it, just like that. They kill the dancer in you. They crush her slowly. They skeleton smoke before she can dance this dance with you. They break your rumba tango. They break you. They dissolve your carnival in urine. They put needles through the skin of your record. They use the trumpet like a knife. And they shatter your violin, just like that. They lock you in walls that have no number, among mirrors and songs covered with ashes. They lock your hands, your feet, your collarbone. And they tell you now, dance, you cripple. Dance now, you bastard. They sentence you to tomb. They scrape you with sand. Let's dance then, my dear, because they're taking away all that we've danced. Right now, listen to the footsteps coming closer, and someone is trying out shiny soldier boots right now. Let's dance, my dear, right now.
Boy, are you good. Boy, I bet you really hold him at reading.
Paul can tell you it's...
Oh,
it's
that's...
It's...
It makes you shiver.